Hello and welcome behind the marquee, the podcast where we talk about what's going on within our art house community in downtown Ann Arbor. My name is Nick Aldrink and I am the programming and media coordinator for the Michigan and State Theater. It has been a while since I've talked to you all here on the mic. As you are probably aware, our doors are closed at the moment and we have been focusing on virtual cinema and other initiatives to keep revenue into the theater. This used to be a roundtable discussion podcast in case you have not been listening for a while. I used to talk to my coworkers and colleagues, but given that I haven't seen them personally in months, it's a bit more difficult to do that. Not to mention, we're all insanely busy. As I said, we're doing everything we can to continue to bring revenue into the theater at this difficult time. Speaking of which, I've taken to hosting virtual trivia on a weekly basis. So our next show is going to be Thursday, December 17th at 7. We're running a holiday movie themed trivia night. Then we will be taking a week off, as the next week after that would be Christmas Eve. And then on the 31st, we're doing a special New Year's Eve themed trivia and virtual cocktail cinema crossover with Russ Collins at 7 o'clock. Tickets will be on sale very soon for that, if they are not already by the time you listen to this. So just a quick plug for trivia. If you want to join us, just visit mishtheater.org/trivia to register. Also, like many local businesses out there, this pandemic has been a rough time for us. We can't play movies like we used to, which is especially disappointing this time of year, as we are typically playing all the Oscar buzz movies. So any way that you can support is greatly appreciated. Just visit mishtheater.org/donate. That's mishtheater.org/donate. mishtheater.org/donate. Again, anything you can give to us at this time is appreciated. But anyways, back to talking about this podcast. It's become a platform for me to talk to directors. You probably, if you have been listening to my Q&As that I've been doing in the past, geez, it's been 9 months now. I keep saying that if there is any silver lining of this pandemic, it has been getting the chance to talk to directors virtually, as I have been doing, because all of a sudden everyone is just available to talk via Zoom on a platform that many of us didn't even know existed 9 months ago. So it's been a real treat. I love talking to filmmakers, and this is another really fun conversation that I had. We opened up this film, Jingle Bell Rocks, from distributor Oscilloscope. Just seemed like an appropriate time to show the film. Then we remember that this is a documentary from the 2014 Cinetopia Film Festival. It follows Mitchell as he explores this world of obscure Christmas music and record collecting. It's fascinating, it's heartwarming, and delightful, and it's the perfect time of year for it if you haven't seen it yet. And if you haven't seen it yet, I suggest you watch the film on our virtual cinema platform and come back to this episode. If you haven't seen it yet, it's not necessarily imperative that you watch the film before you listen here, but I do ask Mitchell some specific questions about plot points in the film that would be beneficial if you saw the film beforehand. But either way, it's a really delightful conversation I had with Mitchell, and I think you'll enjoy it. So that's enough for me. I'll have more to plug at the end of this episode. We'll get right to it. Please enjoy this conversation I had with Mitchell Kezin, director of Jingle Bell Rocks. Hi, Mitchell. Thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today.
Season's greetings, Nick. I'm thrilled to be here.
So your film, Jingle Bell Rocks, it was a selection of the 2014 Cinetopia Film Festival, and you attended that festival, right?
Yes, I did. That was one of my best experiences of the year.
Oh, that's so kind of you to say. I just want to, can you tell us a bit about what was your experience in Detroit and Ann Arbor and with the festival? You had to have visited some record shops along around the area, didn't you?
Well, the first thing that impressed me about the festival was they assigned me my own driver who just like took me anywhere I wanted to go, which was pretty amazing. I've never had an escort like that before at a film festival. Yes, we hit a couple of great record shops. Now, of course, I'm forgetting the name of it. Arhuli Records. Mm-hmm. I believe it's in Ann Arbor. great record shop, and I actually scored a really rare jazz compilation there that I had been searching for years and years. Also, I was there with Bill Adler, one of the collectors from the movie, and he had an old friend from college who was still had his own radio show at the college station. So we dropped in there, and we he gave us full rein to just go nuts with their Christmas archive, digging through and selecting whatever we wanted to play. And we spent about an hour on the radio with him, which was a total blast. And yeah, and then having two separate screening in two different cities was really quite special. And I remember also being so happy that I was there to for the sound check, and before anyone started arriving for the movie itself, the organist was playing Christmas songs,
Oh, is that so?
which was just wonderful. I don't know if you have the same organist still, but he was great.
It was probably, probably one of the, maybe, yeah, we've had a lot of rotating organists, but it was probably one that we still have around today.
Well, he was really kind, and he was a wonderful player.
It's I love hearing Christmas music in the main theater. There's just something magical about hearing it in a grand theater such as
Oh,
I
the
guess
theaters
Academy.
are. I forgot to say that. Yeah, I forgot. Sorry, I'm talking over you.
No, it's all right.
I forgot to mention. Yeah, the majesty of those cinemas. Oh my God, incredible.
So we came across your film available on Oscilloscope right now because it's a pandemic and our theater is closed. And it was one of the titles that Oscilloscope would allow us to play virtually. And we are all familiar with your film already. Have you found that a lot of theaters are playing your film right now, like us?
Yeah, I was quite surprised and delighted that I've had about six different cinemas around America are playing it. Kentucky, Salt Lake City, they're having a special one night only screening on the 22nd. There was one that just went down in Texas on last Friday in Austin, and there's a few more coming up, and then there's yours. So that was all very unexpected and wonderful. I'm hearing from new fans and older fans who are seeing it, for the second or third time, and doing more radio shows and interviews and getting right back into the holiday spirit.
That's really great to hear. This was about 6 years ago that your film was released. I'm assuming this hobby of collecting records has continued since you finished.
It certainly has. It will never stop. I'll never stop searching for interesting, unique, original, obscure Christmas songs and records. So it's also far more than a hobby. It's an obsession and a passion and something that I just po couldn't possibly live without. I go record shopping throughout the whole year, not just for Christmas music, but I'm a collector of early country and western and jazz and blues. But I'm always on the lookout for anything Christmas related. Anytime I'm in a record shop, it's been hard to do that this year because of the pandemic. All of the great shops in the Washington State, which is just over the border from us here, where I live in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, it's about an hour's drive to the border. And then there's about five different independent record stores between Blaine, Washington, and Seattle. And I often will book a cheap motel, and I'll do a tour and hit all those shops, spending about 3 to 4 hours in each one. And some of them require even more time than that, if you can believe it. There's a shop in Bellingham that has a it's in the basement of a large antiques mall, and they have all the regular records out on the floor for display, and then they have this special separate room dedicated to 45s, 7-inch records. And it's completely disorganized. It's like the worst possible kind of junkyard of records, just stacked and piled up 10 feet high and in boxes. And they just let me go crazy. But it takes me a whole day in there because things are just not organized. So, but I always look forward to those trips. So I haven't had to been able to do that this year. And just shopping here locally, which is good. But yeah, it's been severely curtailed this year because of the pandemic.
One thing that I think, at least in my recollection of technology over the past 6 years, since you were filming this, is how much streaming services like Apple Music and Spotify have really hit the big time in terms of popularity.
Yeah.
Has that made it more difficult to find physical records, or is it made it easier? Because I would think the only reason that it would be easier is that people are now bringing their records. Like, I can have this in digital now. I don't need this. I'm curious how this
Right.
has how it has affected your what you call an obsession.
Yeah, that's a great question, and you're dead on. I mean, in one sense, it's great because more people are being exposed to more great Christmas music through all these streaming services, and also through hubs like Bandcamp. But it's becoming like the saturation point is reaching its zenith now. This year, in particular, I was quite surprised. Most of us in this little corner of the world of Christmas collecting that I belong to. There's not just me, there's other guys, it's mostly guys in this game, are also doing this. And so we all were surprised by how many great, really, really good, and some great new Christmas songs were released this season. It's not usually the case. And most of them are being released digitally, of course. So as much as I love the fact that there's more out there, it means that there's more really bad stuff as well. So, for every great Christmas song, and this is just my own personal opinion, of course, there's 10 that are just terrible.
Okay.
And are rushed and just conceptually half-baked and lazy. And, I just, so to answer your question more concisely, yes, it's made it more difficult to find really good stuff because you have more to go to wade through.
Yeah.
But in terms of shopping for physical product, which is what I mostly love to do, I don't buy much online. I buy the occasional thing on eBay because sometimes someone will have an old rare 45 that they've put up for sale. It's mostly the singles that I'm after these days.
Yeah.
Especially singles, jazz, blues, soul, funk from like the 50s, 60s, and 70s. Sort of the golden era of really, really good Christmas music.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you, and then I want to get back to what you call the golden era of Christmas music, because I want to dig into
Sure.
that a little bit more. But you mentioned eBay, and I remember that the very beginning of your film, you mentioned that you find a CD that's, I think it's $3.99, but you could be sold, it can be sold on eBay for $60 to $80. Is that something you do? Do you sell records as well, or is it more just collecting?
No, I have to feed this ha I have to feed this habit somehow and afford it. So I sell as not as much as I buy, unfortunately. So I have a very limited budget. I'm a documentary filmmaker, so I'm not a rich man. But yeah, I buy and sell a lot because I kind of have a sense now after being in this game for over 30 years. I'm pretty hip to what will sell and what will get good money. It's not worth selling something for smaller amounts because you got to package them perfectly and the record has to be in mint condition and all kinds of things can go wrong. So the labor involved in selling an item on eBay is pretty actually far more involved and extensive than people realize. But I've got it down to an art form now, and the only way I can afford to buy as much Christmas music as I do is because I sell a lot of other records that I come across. Or sometimes I'll come across a duplicate and I'll replace a slightly lesser quality version of an LP that I might have. So I'll sell the one that I'll keep the good one, I'll sell the other one, that kind of thing.
When you find a record that you've never heard of, I know that in the footage of you mining through the crates,
Yeah.
you can just tell that sometimes you find a record, you don't know what it is, it's a dollar. What is a rec If you've never heard of it, what does a record have to convey to you in order you for you to believe that it's a winner, that you need it.
Actually, those are the songs and those are the records that I search for the most. It's a discovery. It's a search for the unknown. I don't have like a list of albums I'm searching for, although I do have a few records that are elusive and very rare that I still don't have in my collection. I'm looking for stuff that I don't know exists. And the way I can tell if it's good is a couple of things. The particular label that it's on, as in the record label, the company who's produced it, in other words. Every 45 single or every record on the back has and the name of the company who made it, the record label who produced the record, and then usually an address. So I've come to know a lot of the independent labels now over the years. So that's one clear sign that it's going to be good.
Okay.
Second sign is where does it come from? If it's anywhere in the South, I'll buy it just because I think the chances are it's going to be really good. And then it's about the song titles. If it's, I'm trying to think of a one off the top of my head as an example. Well, let's just use a song that was released this year by a band called Randolph's Leap. I know that band. They're from Scotland. They had a great Christmas song that they released last year. But this year they had a new one, and the title of the song is Stay Away This Christmas. So if I picked up a 45 in a record shop that I had no idea what it was, but it had that title, I would snag it right away
Got
because
it.
it's interesting, it's unique, it's clearly not yet another cover of a classic chestnut. And so that's enough to compel me to put a dollar down. If it gets into the $10 and up range, well, that's when I'll listen, take a little listen and just drop the needle down on it and listen. I can tell within 5, 10 seconds if I'm going to dig it or not, usually.
So in regards to music, Christmas music today, do you feel like Christmas music, new Christmas music, is getting better than it used to be, or is it getting worse? Because I know that everyone wants to do their cover of Silent Night or Sleigh Bells and whatnot, and then but then there's the weird, at least in the top four, there's that weird Mariah Carey song that gets played every year. That's usually the newest that gets played. Do you feel like artists, yeah, back to my original question, do you feel that artists are recording better new Christmas music now than they used to?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. It's getting better and better every year. And again, this year I'm just blown away by how much great stuff is out there. And I guess it's because I'm assuming we're all trying to figure this out because it's so unusual to have this many good, really good songs. But I think people just had more time because they were not able to tour and perform. So musicians and artists had more time to contemplate the writing of a new Christmas song, I suppose, and they had maybe more time to record it. And it allowed them the space to really dig deep and have something unique to say. And yeah, every year there's more and more stuff that really impresses me. And this has been a real banner year for sure.
I have a few.
There's a lot of, sorry,
No.
there's a lot of COVID related Christmas songs, as you can imagine.
Oh, I haven't heard those. I'll have to check those
It's like
out.
almost becoming a genre of its own, to be honest.
I have a feeling that it has something to do with the reason why I think that your film is so special as well, because it gets everyone to think about, you look at all these obscure Christmas songs and you relate to, you ask these artists, how does your music relate to your childhood Christmas? And I think that right now that's something that we're just yearning for, to think of the good old days when Christmas was magical and happy, as opposed to this bummer season that we're in right now. I don't know.
Yeah, no, I think that's a very astute comment. I think
Yeah.
that's precisely what's going on for many people. I mean, it's been such a brutal year. So much, death and people losing their jobs and losing their businesses and losing their loved ones. It's horrible. And
Yeah.
it's not thing it's getting worse and not better. And thank God Joe Biden won the election and things will eventually change, but
Yeah.
it's going to take a while,
Yeah, absolutely.
So by next Christmas, though, we'll be celebrating in style, and it'll be Christmas 2021 will be one of the best ever. in history, I think. I hope.
Yeah, you heard it here,
So this
folks.
year we just got to get through it.
Switching gears just a little bit, as we're talking about writing Christmas music, I like the line that you made, and it's something that I've recognized, at least in the terms of Irving Berlin. Like, there's a passing line about how Christmas music is, at least the traditional Christmas music, is written primarily by Jewish men. Why is that? I just have to. I wonder if you have any history or theories about that.
Well, I did think about it a lot because I was going to make a follow-up film about that exact subject.
Okay.
But another Canadian filmmaker who is himself Jewish beat me to the punch and made his own film about that topic.
Oh, all right.
It wasn't anything like what I would have made, and I still might make mine because it's a really great, rich subject to explore. And it's something that's always confounded me and made me wonder, like, why? I think it's just by the sheer fact that not just Christmas songs, but so many of the best, most recognizable, most cherished, most beloved songs in our lives were written in the heyday of Tin Pan Alley and what came afterwards, and Irving Berlin being the most sort of prime example of a composer coming out of that era, writing just one great song after another. In terms of Jewish songwriters writing great Christmas songs, and most of the chestnuts that we all love and know well and hear ad nauseum now, were written by Jewish songwriters, almost exclusively male songwriters who were Jewish. And I guess they had. Maybe they are at a remove from the holiday, so they're able to see it in a different way, and therefore their perspective is one that's more contemplative, and they can, they have the perspective to write something that they can see expresses the holiday for the folks who are celebrating it who aren't Jewish, which is, I'm not sure. I don't know what the answer is to that. That's why I wanted to make that movie, and so I may have to make that movie to satisfy my interest in answering that question more properly than I have just now. But it's a fascinating phenomenon, though, and not, I think not a lot of people know this. That a lot, most people know Irving Berlin wrote White Christmas, but I don't think they know that. Name almost any chestnut and Silver Bells, I wish I was the kind of person who could just rattle off songs and names off the top of my head, but I'm not that kind of guy. So
Well,
sadly, I can't do that for you right now.
it's
But
not.
they all, if you look it up, if you look it up, name the top 10 Christmas classics of all time were all written by Jews.
But I guess in regards to, I'm a turning the topic a little bit again.
Sure.
In regard to other projects that you have worked on, I noticed that you're working on a film about Bob Dorough.
Yes, I am. It's sort of it's on hiatus at the moment because of the pandemic. We can't travel or film, but that's in the works. And man, he's someone who I came to know very. We got to be pretty close pals. And after we made the movie together, for folks who haven't seen the film, Bob Dorough was the creator and genius behind Schoolhouse Rock. And in my movie, I explore a song that he wrote, a Christmas song that he wrote called Blue Xmas, To Whom It May Concern, which was a collaboration with Miles Davis. And so once I met Bob and we did all the filming for Jingle Bell Rocks, and he told the story of working with Miles, I've always been a fan of his since I was a kid, since Schoolhouse Rock. And then as I grew older and I started to get into buying my own music and listening to artists that I loved, I found out more about Bob and his career and other songs and records he'd released. And he's just so unique and special. And I knew that one day I needed to make a film about him and his life. And so I started that movie back in, gosh, four and a half years ago. It's been a slog because I still haven't yet been able to raise very much money, which is remarkable because he's so important to American pop culture and to education for children, and what Schoolhouse Rock has done for the culture is It's really amazing. When he passed away, the number of tributes to him was really just touched my heart, because yeah, I don't think he realized how much he was beloved around the world, not just in America.
I love that moment in the film when you first meet him. That what was the, that where that was the first time you meet him on camera, right? Where you give him a hug, you
Yeah,
hug each
in
other.
person. Yes, in person. We had spoken by phone, of course, and by email. But that was real. That was the first time I saw him in the flesh, and I was so I wasn't exactly nervous. I don't get nervous meeting people like celebrities. Even when I met Rev Run DMC, I wasn't nervous, but I guess anxious maybe was is a better word. You're just like, I can't believe I'm standing in front of this person who I just idolize so much and love so much and respect so much that, and here we are, and we're actually doing this. I'm going to sit down and interview him about his song. I wouldn't have made the movie. Had Bob Dorough said no to me, I wouldn't have made the film for sure. He was too integral to the whole story and storyline, and the whole emphasis on the kind of music that I really dig. And I mean, it was his. Well, I don't want to give too much away, but as people will know once they watch the movie, it was Bob's song that really turned me on to the realization that there had to be more unique, original Christmas songs like this out there in the world. I just wasn't aware of them, so I had to start searching for them. But his was the one, so I owe him a huge debt of gratitude, and he knew that. We spent a lot of time off camera talking about writing music, and in the new film, which hopefully will be finished in the next 2 years, 3 years maybe.
I really hope you get to. I'd love to screen that at the theater.
Oh,
To
absolutely. It'll be great. If we can find the money, it's going to be great. I mean, I'll get it done come hell or high water, just like I got GM La Rock done, but I hope it doesn't take 8 years the way this last film did.
I want to ask about the Calypso version of The Little Boy That Santa Forgot that you
Sure.
recorded in the film. I know that you see that your initial conversation with the record store owners. I apologize, I forget their names, but
Ralston Charles of Charlie's Calypso City
yes, thank you.
in Brooklyn. Yeah.
What was the conversation that inspired you? You mentioned the conversation, the pact that you had to record that song. What was that conversation that inspired you to record in their studio?
Well, it wasn't so much a conversation as just sort of a light bulb went off. Like, I literally was, well, first of all, I'd never been to that record shop before. We had been trying to find a really cool New York store to film in, because everywhere we went to interview anyone, we'd always also take a day out and go visit a local record shop, and we'd always film that and hope that I'd discover something really cool and unique, and that could be a scene included in the film. And I also just wanted the chance to go record shopping. So if the company's going to pay for it, then sure, I'll go along and we can film that, no problem. So I said, so we talked with about, I don't know, six, seven, eight different shops, and most of them wouldn't let us come and film. The three that did, one was in Greenwich Village and it's now gone, which was sad news. He closed the shop down about 3 years ago. Forgetting the name, sorry. Point being, we went to two other shops, and they were really disappointing. They didn't yield anything useful in terms of footage, and I was really dejected. I'm like, come on, this is New York effing city. We can't find a great record store that we can find some interesting Christmas records. There was other music at the time in Manhattan, but they didn't have a Christmas section, which I was like, oh, okay, you. They were kind of snotty. It's like, oh, you're too good to have Christmas music, right?
of course.
Anyway, so I said to Bill, come on. Like, I was really choked. I was really upset. I was like, I can't believe this. I said, there's got to be somewhere else. And he goes, oh. He said, what about Charlie's Calypso City? I mean, the name alone, I'm like, What? What are you talking? Like, as soon as I said the name, I was like, well, yes. Say no more, but tell me more. Okay. And he's like, oh, it's an old pal of mine, Charlie. He's a real character. He'll probably charge you for it, but it'd be interesting to go there. It's in Brooklyn. We could do it, whatever, blah, blah, blah. Next to the, I said, give me his number. I'll call him and we'll work it out. So there's actually a scene that we didn't include in the film of me on the phone driving along the Hudson River, negotiating with Charlie for the fees to film at his store. It's pretty funny. It didn't even end up on the DVD, but if I can dig it up, I'll send it to you. It's pretty hysterical.
Why on?
I got him down from $500 to 200 and change, I think.
Oh, got it.
Yeah, he was something else. So I could tell just from talking with him on the phone that he was going to be an interesting cat to talk with. And I mean, that's another genre of music I collect a lot is calypso music. And calypso Christmas music is a very, very rich genre and hard to find. And when you do find anything that's of worth, it's usually super expensive
Oh, got it.
because it's so rare. But Charlie had his hand in producing a lot of big artists from the 50s, 60s, and 70s onward. But I didn't know at the time that Bill said we should go there and do some shot and shoot a scene. I had no idea there was a studio upstairs. I didn't even know that whole side of Charlie's world. So we get there and we're filming, and I'm giving a little bit away, but I guess people are going to hear this podcast after they see the film, right? That's the idea.
That's the idea, yeah.
Okay. So I won't give everything away, but it so happened that we were filming on the day that they were getting ready for a party. And they had the equivalent of what would be Jamaican moonshine in the back
I
fridge.
saw
And
that, yeah.
yeah, Charlie always, his store is like a hangout for the neighborhood. So all these retired old cats are there hanging around, playing cards, shooting the breeze, and drinking a lot. And so he offered me one of these cocktails. I said, oh, sure, I'll have one. And then I had a second, and I had a third, and I was getting pretty tipsy. And we were still filming. I was like, oh boy, I better slow down here. And so that's when, well, I don't want to say too much because I don't want to give away that whole
Yeah.
scene. But we discovered there was a studio upstairs. And we went up there, and I'm sitting there just marveling and hearing stories about all the people that had recorded in that studio. And the name The Mighty Sparrow came up in that conversation. This was the one of the guys who was also happened to be hanging out there was the engineer for all those sessions back in the heyday of the studio. So he mentioned all these, all these big name hip hop artists, and then he mentioned Mighty Sparrow, and I said, Mighty Sparrow, are you serious? He's like, oh yeah, we're dear friends, and he lives not far. He lives in Queens, but he's recorded here a whole bunch. And I was like, you're kidding me. And then I just said, oh my God, well, this is what we have to do. And that was it. And you saw that moment
Yeah.
captured in the film. And then later, when we got home back to the hotel, when we finished shooting each day, we have a sort of a after shoot meeting, and we just go over the day's events and talk about what went down. And my producer said, were you really serious about that? Like, is that what you want to do? And I was like, Mila, that's exactly what I want to do. That's how we're going to end the film. This couldn't be more perfect. I mean, I had a really horrible cockamamie ending for the movie that involved this massive set piece that was going to be built, and I was going to trek to the North Pole, and it was going to be revealed that Santa Claus had his own private record room, and I was going to go in there, and he was going to be watching me, and I was digging through his record collection, and it just so happened he had the Nat King Cole record. Oh, the whole thing was just so sappy and ridiculous, and would have been impossible to pull off because we had no money for sets or anything. So it was an idea that I was happy to throw away and replace with what does end the movie, and that's what I'll say about it. But it was literally just, it had, some people think that whole thing was constructed, like a drama. They don't believe that I didn't know any of this beforehand, that I didn't set it up. They think the whole thing was set up.
Yeah,
I don't understand how they can think that when, A, it's a documentary you're watching,
right,
and B, it seems clear to me that it's just,
yeah,
that it's a spontaneous thing where I just go, oh my God, we'll get Sparrow. Because earlier, now I am going to give some stuff away. Earlier, we talk, you know, the guys start singing the Nat King Cole song. Not prompted by me. Bill mentions it, and they're like, they know the song.
Oh, perfect.
It's a big song in their world. That blew my mind. Are you kidding me? And then I like, so that's why I said, so if that's the case, then Sparrow must have recorded this in the past. And they said, no, I don't think so. We've never heard it if he has.
Yeah.
I'm like, well, then we have to do it ourselves. This is perfect.
Yeah, it just sounds like something that was just so perfectly in the cards for you there. That's
one
magical.
Of those magical things that sometimes happens with documentary films. I mean, that's why I love making them. When you have an accident like that, it's like it was like literally willed to happen because I needed it so bad.
Yeah.
And I sort of, you know, it's almost like, oh, that you, this is happening because of everything that came before it. And it's just, it is truly magical and it's truly unbelievable. If you told someone that that's what happened, they wouldn't believe you, but it did. And it's wonderful. And I was so grateful that Sparrow wanted to do it.
And what's happened to that record since? I'm assuming it was printed on a 45 or something like that.
You mean the that's in my film? The
version
we recorded?
Yeah.
Well, we recorded, what we did was, because it was Sparrow and I had limited time and we paid him well, I asked him to do, I was already thinking about releasing a 45. So I thought we'll have a happy side, which will be an upbeat Calypso version with the whole band. One of the things that attracted Sparrow to agreeing to do this was I said, I'm not going to use any MIDI instruments. It's all going to be old school, real horn section, steel pan drums. We're going to have, you know, everyone. We're going to bring like a 12-piece band in there, and we're going to do it right and properly, the way you used to record in the 50s and 60s. And when I said that to him, he just lit up. He's like, I'm in. He didn't say it exactly that way, but that's what clinched the deal, was that I wanted to record this the way he used to record music. That nothing would be, there'd be no sampled trumpets or horns or anything. Sorry, I'm trying to, that's a long-winded answer to your question. You said, what's happened to that song?
Yeah.
So we recorded the upbeat Calypso version, and then we recorded the happy side, and then we recorded the sad side, which was a more faithful ballad, almost identical to way Nat sang his,
okay,
including the little spoken word, part in the middle, the poem in the middle. And then we did an a cappella, just him singing it through alone and then reading the poem. And we also did one other version. Anyway, that's all sitting on a hard drive. And every year that comes around, I think I got to release it this year for Record Store Day. And then I miss my opportunity. And it costs a lot of money to do this properly. So I'm going to try and generate a Kickstarter next year.
Oh, that's a great idea. Yeah.
Because I know he has a ton of fans and people would die for this.
Yeah.
So that's how we're going to do it. Unless I can find a really rich benefactor to just put up the money and help me do it. That might also work. We'll see. But I definitely, Sparrow's getting older. He's 85 now. And I want this to come out before he's gone. So we got to do it for next Christmas. And I think given, you know, this year and how bad everything is, it'll be perfect to release it next year.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because everyone will want to celebrate, and there's nothing better to celebrate with alongside than the Mighty Sparrow singing an upbeat Calypso song originally recorded by Nat King Cole.
Yeah.
Come on.
Yeah. Especially we were robbed of a proper Record Store Day this year as well. It'd be a perfect time to launch it. Yeah,
yeah.
Next year.
Yeah. I'm really excited.
Yeah. Give it.
So we'll probably do like a 10-inch, and we'll have like Yeah, I'm not sure what we'll do, but it'll be special. It'll be very special.
I'll keep an eye out for that.
Definitely. Well, I'll make sure I save you a copy.
Thanks. Given the obscurity of some of the tracks on in your soundtrack, did that make it easier or harder to get the music rights for this film?
Oh, way, way
Oh
harder.
yeah.
There's a couple of songs that we couldn't find who owned them. So legally, you just have to have a really solid paper trail and show your due diligence and show that you did everything you possibly could to locate who wrote this and recorded it and where it came from. But it's funny, so many songs now are owned by one of three companies.
Yeah.
There's BMG, Universal, Warner Chappell has songwriting rights to almost everything. And I forget the other company, Sony. Yeah, I said Sony BMG. Yeah, there's like three companies that own most 99% of the music that's out there in the world now.
Yeah.
So, but there was a bunch that stumped them that we couldn't find any information about. But negotiating was initially tricky. But what we ended up doing was something called a Most Favored Nations deal, which is a special kind of way you go about, especially you can do this in a documentary because what it's not considered a commercial use. It's like you're licensing the song for educational or informational reasons. Like you're talking about it in a way that the song becomes something that's a subject of itself, if that makes any sense. So you can do something called Most Favored Nations where you just everyone gets paid the same amount and everyone agrees to that deal. And I won't reveal what that was in dollars, but it was ridiculously cheap in
Oh,
the
okay.
end. But times it by 31 songs that are in the movie,
Oof.
and it was still very expensive.
Yeah.
But like, for instance, we didn't end up having to pay a normal sort of $40,000 to $50,000 for Miles Davis, for instance, But there was a very tricky negotiation that took the better part of a year and a half.
Yeah.
So that was hard. And what was really scary was that we went ahead and filmed all this, film made the whole movie without knowing for sure that we had the rights to the songs that the film was built around. And I'm
Yeah.
like, this is crazy, you guys. Like, that's how my producers wanted to go about it. But it made no sense to me. Like, what if we can't get this song?
Yeah, that's
The whole film falls apart.
yeah.
But fortunately, we've managed to.
Yeah. Well, I think that it was all well worth it, and because this I wasn't even aware of, and now I'm forgetting their name. The Free Design, is that the name of the
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
I went in and I was exploring some of their tracks because I love
Yeah.
that Laurel Canyon sound that they had.
Yeah. Oh, they're wonderful. They're amazing.
I just want to thank you again for making this film. I'm so glad we had the chance to show it virtually this time, and for giving me your time to speak with
Well,
you.
that's incredibly kind. It's my pleasure, really. You asked some great questions, and it's been a pleasure speaking with you. And I hope you get lots of watchers rather, and listeners to the podcast, and watchers of the film. And hopefully, I'll be out to Cinetopia sooner than later.
Oh, I hope that as well. Now, where can listeners, you mentioned a lot of,
Oh,
yeah,
good.
or yeah,
Yeah.
where can they go to find you? Where can they find the projects that you're working on?
Well, the easiest way is to just go to, they can email me, Mitchell at JingleBellRocks, RockS.com, or they can find Jingle Bell Rocks Doc on Facebook and Twitter. But I forgot to tell you this. This is quite exciting news. We didn't end up talking about my Merry Mix, but every year I put together a 90-minute or 80-minute CD compilation of all the best stuff I found that year, and I make a little audio Christmas card that I send out to all my family and friends and fans now, and that will be finished in about a week's time. I'm a bit late this year for different reasons, but it's called Mitchell's Merry Mix, and this is the 30th year I've done this. So I have 30 individual Merry Mixes that all are going to be showcased and featured in a brand new website for everyone to access and take a look. So they can go to mitchellsmerrymix.com
Okay.
in about 3 days.
Oh, perfect. I'm so glad you brought that up. I
Yeah.
had that as something I was going to ask you about, but there was something that I drifted over. So I'm glad
No
you had a chance
problem.
to plug that.
Yeah. So the best way is just to go to jinglebellrocks.com. There's a contact page there, and the movie's there, and everything that they can want is there to reach me.
And when your Kickstarter comes up, or maybe something that going on with the Bob Dural film, where can they find
Oh
more
yeah.
information about that?
That's also on Twitter under Duro Doc. DoroughDoc. Duro Doc.
Perfect. I'll make sure to keep our eyes on that. Thank you once again.
Yeah, it's been
Yeah.
wonderful, Nick. Thank
And
you. And happy holidays.
happy holidays and stay safe.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye. Thank you once again to Mitchell for giving me his time. After we stopped recording there, I was actually telling him about the film Vinyl Nation that we played this summer. And I told him in many ways his film is a predecessor to Vinyl Nation. So if you enjoyed this conversation, I suggest you go back and listen to my Q&A with the directors Kevin Smokler and Christopher Boone. That one was actually a Facebook Live Q&A. So if you want to be a part of more stuff like that, be sure to follow the Michigan and State Theater on Facebook. While you're at it, give us your attention on Twitter and Instagram as well. Our handles are at Michigan Theater and at State Theater A2. Michigan Theater is spelled with an ER. State Theater, the theater is spelled with an RE. Just be sure to make that note. Or you can find it at the Ann Arbor District Library website, who I'd like to also thank for hosting our podcast on Apple iTunes and now Spotify. You can find us on Spotify. If you have not already, be sure to subscribe and give us a rating, as that is how we will be able to pick up more listeners. Thank you to Matt from the Ann Arbor District Library for making sure these episodes drop on a timely basis. If you want to get a hold of the podcast, send me an email at btmpod@gmail.com. We'll be back in your feed. I'm not sure when. As I said at the top of this episode, it's very busy for us right now. So as soon as I get a chance to talk to another director, I'm sure I'll be back in your feed. And I'm trying to gather everyone for another roundtable discussion podcast before the end of the year. So this will not be the last you hear from me until the end of this year that we call 2020. I promise you that. So keep a lookout for us. Do all the things I told you to do to be notified as soon as a new episode drops. Thank you for listening, and thank you for joining us behind the marquee.